The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
I think they're hungry for it because it gives them something to ground in.
Yeah.
Where they can say, this change thing is hard. I've never learned how to do it. I'm being asked to do it and own it. And that's scary and it's vulnerable. And if there's something that can help me understand it better, I think it's just helping them be better leaders. And at the end of the day, that's what all leaders want to be, is better leaders for their people.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Grunewald, and today I'm joined by Travis Haler. Travis has some cool titles. So we've got founder of the Neurological Nomad, senior director of global strategy and transformation at Salesforce, I guess most recently author of Rethink Resistance. So I'm particularly excited to dive into Rethink Resistance and everything that's behind embracing neuroscience to lead transformational change. Neuroscience is definitely capturing a lot of my attention right now. So welcome, Travis.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here, Dane.
I'm stoked for the conversation, and I always like to start with, like, tell me more about how you came to be doing this really cool work that you're doing right now.
It's a great question. I'll give you the short and the long. The short version is that I've just always been really fascinated by why people do what they do. Human behavior has always been such a fascinating part of my life and my journey, and kind of how I've looked at the world, especially when people are, you know, faced with pressure or difficult situations or put in a spot where they have to react. And so my background from there kind of started with psychology and neuroscience and then moved into business. And at first I thought that those had to be very separate paths. And so I thought, okay, studied the brain and human behavior. Now I'm going into organizations and strategy and transformation as business. Then I realized really quickly that they were never separate. And they were always together, and business problems I was working on were really always human behavior beneath and underneath those problems. And so over, you know, gosh, 15 years, almost two decades, I've worked with a number of companies. And what I kept seeing time and time again is that leaders would have really good strategies. They'd have logic behind those strategies. They would communicate clearly in most cases, but people would stall, or they'd push back, or they'd quietly comply, but also like quietly not comply at the same time and go back to those old ways of working. And I kept seeing that happen over and over again. And I kept listening to leaders talk about their experiences through transformation. And they would consistently talk about that as something that they were dealing with or something that kept popping up for them. And so that kind of sent me deeper into the what's happening in our brains and why are people doing that when they're faced with change? And I found that resistance that people were describing, and that what I heard leaders talk about battling, you know, an us versus them kind of mentality, was actually a very natural process of protection for us as people. And that became kind of the foundation of this book, the Rethink Resistance. It's, you know, a practical guide for leaders to stop fighting resistance and start understanding what it's telling them and what's underneath and why people behave the way that they do.
Oh, I love that. That's very cool, because I liked this whole, you've got it on your LinkedIn profile, resistance isn't rebellion, it's biology. So that really grounds it in, hey, it's not a me problem, it's not a company problem, it's human first.
Well, and I think that's really an important differentiation, because I found that a lot of leaders, and I talk about leadership in a couple different ways, and sometimes it makes me a little unpopular because people don't love the way that I characterize leadership, but leadership requires a level of ego. And what happens when you bring something to a group of people, it's one, it's vulnerable, and two, it requires you to have that little bit of ego and confidence to be able to bring something and get people to buy in. Naturally, people don't immediately buy in. The natural reaction to change is resistance. And so you'd have these leaders who would take that as a very personal attack on them and their leadership. And then their reaction back. So if the person's reaction was resistance, their reaction to their reaction is to push harder and be authoritarian and force it through. And then you just create this really toxic culture happening within transformation. And then you've created this environment that we live in as this world where transformation is an ugly word and it's a terrible thing and everyone, you know, has traumatic experiences with transformation.
Yeah.
When transformation can actually be an extremely beautiful moment of growth for people if you do it right.
That's fascinating. The transformation as a big T trauma has been getting a lot of attention lately because so many companies are like throwing out 50 projects at once and it's just like, whoa, where am I at? So I guess in big corporations when there are lots of changes going on versus in a small company where the CEO walks in and says, hey, we're changing these three things this quarter, they're both transformations, but just the scale, the proximity, the weight of some of that work can, I imagine, cause a lot of different protective responses in individuals and teams.
Absolutely. I mean, it all creates some form of that, you know, big T trauma for folks. But I think when you're in a large organization, and especially in a time like today, where AI is disrupting every industry, every size organization on the planet, mm-hmm. you have large organizations that in order to pivot have to make 50 changes right now.
Yeah.
There is no time in their minds, right? And that creates a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety within the general working population.
Oh yeah. I've got some friends who work at Oracle right now. And we were just talking this week about how they let thousands of people go by email and there wasn't really a plan, a transition, a handoff. It was just like, to your point, we've got to make this shift. Here it is. And let's work our way through it. But naturally, it causes a huge degree of not just uncertainty around, you know, what's my job security, but a huge degree of kind of confusion around, well, I used to go to Billy over here for that. And where do I go now? And mm-hmm. the chaos that ensues, I guess, in those large organization changes, will take a long time to unpick and unfold.
Well, and I talk about loss and change as hand in hand, right?
Yeah.
You can't have change without some form of loss. And I mean, you just described it beautifully around there's three types of changes that, you know, that result in loss or types of losses from change that happen in organizations. It's competence, it's relationships, which you just described, mm-hmm. and it's control.
Yeah.
And I think what you hit on hit all three of those all at the same time, right? Like I used to know the person I went to, that person was my competence that I was depending on, and I lost the control of understanding what's even happening in this
moment. I love that framing.
It's really powerful, and I think we skip right over that in corporate America a lot.
It's interesting. I had a friend called Ngo who's on the podcast, and he was telling me from South Africa post-apartheid, one of the things that Mandela did very well was he distributed the loss. So when he came into power, he worked with all the different groups to say, hey, there's been stuff behind us that was hard. There's going to be stuff in front of us that's hard. Let's each take our piece of the loss so that we go forwards knowing what burden we're carrying and how it serves us to go towards this goal. And I'd never heard it framed like that before, but the way you shape loss, it becomes perhaps if it's the thing people are going to be focusing on, it's a very interesting map or dashboard to be talking to people about as you walk them through that change.
Well, it gives leaders something to anchor in, something to ask about, something to acknowledge. And sometimes it's not even about asking, it's about just simply showing up. And I think that's why the book exists, to be honest, not to bring it back to the book.
Yeah,
Dane,
let's do it.
The book exists because leaders need some way to enter these conversations with some form of backpack or toolkit that they can carry the support with. And if a leader understands the barrier that loss represents for people, and they can acknowledge it and come with, okay, there's three types of barriers. I'm going to just guess based on this change. Here's the biggest one that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
You can come with, you know, things in your back pocket. And I say that a lot with systems. I'm like, okay, you're taking an accounting or finance team from one accounting or finance system to another. Well, you just destroyed competence, right?
Yes.
So showing up to that conversation and not already having a plan for how they're going to rebuild competence is probably a bad move. right? And it's not going to build, it's not going to get you any points. It's definitely not going to build trust.
Yes.
So if you show up to that conversation and say, I understand how much of a loss this is and the competence that we've built and using the system. Here's the plan that we have. We've partnered with this third party that's going to come in and run a bunch of trainings for us. I'm going to give you each time during the week to be able to actually play with the new system before this happens. We're also going to bring on some additional support folks that are going to help us through the tough month end and year end closes. Like saying that, don't you immediately just like exhale and you're like, okay, whew, feel better.
Yeah. Whew. It's that seen, valued, heard. It's starting with the you of, hey, you've gone through this change and I understand that it's hard before you start telling them where you need to go. That's brilliant. I love that scaffolding. It's very powerful. You said earlier about ego. So even when you give someone a toolkit, we often forget that the leader's carrying a lot of uncertainty and concern into a change effort as well. It's not just the team that's getting impacted. The leader's taking big risks. There's pressure from above, whether it's a boss or a board or outside shareholders. What is it, going back to that ego point, that allows them to be ready to use the toolkit, ready to reach for your book and say, whew, there's some stuff here for me to do, but I've just spent 20 years doing it one way. Why would I now use this new toolkit and be a little bit more thoughtful, caring? You used the word pre-show, spend more time on the care and the experience of the people than the programmatic scheduling of tasks.
So what I've found, so two things. One, there's three different roles in change that exist. One is you're leading change, meaning it was your idea and you're asking other people to change. Mm-hmm. Two, you're driving change, which means it wasn't your idea, but you're being asked to ask other people to do it.
Yeah.
And there's recipients of change. Now, most leaders sit in the driver of change seat because, let's be honest, most changes come from our C-suite and are being asked to be, you know, put into place. So for leaders, what I think makes them reach for a framework or a field guide like this is that they're managing both being asked to change themselves through this process and asking someone else to change too, all at the same time.
Yes.
And the beauty of this book and of the neuroscience behind it is that, and I joked, I said this a few times in interviews, that my original plan for the book was, if you read it one way, it was from the perspective of a leader. And if you flipped it over and read it the other way, it came from the perspective of a recipient.
Yeah.
For many logistical reasons, that was not a viable product. But that was very hard. But the reality is that the barriers of change neurologically don't change whether you are the person who's asking or the person being asked.
Brilliant.
So they still exist. So if you understand it as a leader, you can manage your own barriers while also managing the barriers of your team and helping them understand and also helping you get what you need going through that process. And what I've found, and through talking with thousands of leaders at this point, is that most leaders, while they have this level of ego that allows them to lead and that confidence to lead, there is a lot of vulnerability and a lot of concern that they have about their ability to lead. I think that they sit in this place of, I want everyone to think that I'm very confident and I have all these skills and everything, but I think they sit very lonely in this moment of like, I was never really trained to be a leader.
Yeah.
I learned it through trial and error. And so giving them something as a field guide style book that they can reach for, I think they're hungry for it because it gives them something to ground in.
Yeah.
Where they can say, this change thing is hard. I've never learned how to do it. I'm being asked to do it and own it. And that's scary and it's vulnerable. And if there's something that can help me understand it better, I think it's just helping them be better leaders. And at the end of the day, that's what all leaders want to be, is better leaders for their people.
Brilliant. No, I love that. And I think that concern about ability to lead and the neurological resistance to the change you're going through as a driver in a mid-level leadership role is pretty widely felt right now. You know, everyone's talking about employee engagement crisis, but my friend Jonathan Raymond, who wrote the book Good Authority, he talks about us having a manager engagement crisis. And from what I'm hearing here, Travis, if someone reaches for Rethink Resistance, has the field guide, they can start to do the work for themselves and for their team. then they're going to be, you know, in a better regulated, more intentional space to be doing the work that they and their team members need.
Absolutely. And, you know, what I also talk about a lot is transformation is an opportunity. And it's a moment where you can either step aside and say, like, I'm going to sit up here and you guys all do the change. Or you can be vulnerable and honest and you can go through it with your team. You don't get many opportunities as a leader to stand shoulder to shoulder with your team through something hard. And the reason that, you know, you think about militaries and, you know, things like that, they go through these grueling tasks and trainings as a unit, as a cohort. And the reason they do that is because doing something really hard together bonds people together. And so doing that as a leader with your team through a transformation only builds a stronger team, only builds stronger relationships, and only builds a better team. So it's really an amazing opportunity to do that. But you have to have tools to be able to feel confident to be that vulnerable. That's a very vulnerable spot as a leader to go to.
I know a lot of, I'm really glad you brought that one up, Travis, because I know a lot of people, when they think about teamwork, I think the science is the epiphany effect. When you come through something hard together, you build deeper bonds. So what they'll do is they'll build a lower stakes experience rather than the actual work. From your research, from your writing, from your lived experience, what creates higher fidelity for a leader in actually bringing the team together shoulder to shoulder to go through a real change versus going and doing a ropes course or a mystery box or, you know, a NASCAR pit crew assimilation?
It's a great question. So they're synthetic at the end of the day, right? Like, they don't truly exist in real life. Like, going into an escape room, you know, I love doing activities like that with teams. I think it's fun. But everyone knows that when you walk out of there, there were no stakes involved and it was kind of silly. And like, you, it was your, I think most people see it as a moment to like kind of let loose rather than a moment to like tackle something difficult together, right? And I think that's what takes the fidelity out of it, to use your word. Is that where we do it in moments of, this is outside of work and it's like fun and it's supposed to be, you know, engaging and just doing something non-work related. And I don't think people see it in the same way that they see like a large scale transformation that you're going through and battling something hard together. It's supposed to be fun, right? It doesn't yield the same
result. So you don't, if that threat chemistry, if that protection isn't firing, then people aren't really bringing their full experience and a set of emotions to the table as a team to manage the change, is what I hear you say.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You said it much more eloquently than I did.
Thank you. The that's cool. Okay, so my next question on that then, and this may tie back to the book or a particular experience, is you said it yourself earlier, when a leader brings ego into a room and says, we're making this change, and they take it a bit personally when the resistance comes, they'll tend to just push harder and push through it. Or what I've seen is leaders will be like, well, Travis doesn't really like where I'm taking this, but I know I can rely on Jenny over here and Lydia over there. I'm going to pull those two together and make them my team to go through the change. So they work around the person. So you're either pushing hard through or you're working around. How does a leader go about picking the team to go on the change journey with them? Like, is it the whole team? Is it selecting people because they represent different, you know, competencies, relationship, control in the organization? I'm intrigued by that.
Well, for most transformations that I've been a part of are, you know, it's kind of all or nothing. The whole team is going. There's not an alternative to be like, I'm going to pick Dane and Dane and I are going to do this and you guys can wait here. So that's most of the transformations I do. I know that that exists, but it's not in the transformations I've worked on. So for me, when I look at those types of transformations and you're looking at that team, what oftentimes happens is that, first off, this takes a long time to become cultural, right? So doing good transformation work is not a, we did it one time and now it has become the norm that everyone's going to expect. It's time after time showing up in that way and making that the cultural norm. And part of that is actually every time making sure that the folks that are actually coming along on that journey, helping the ones that are not afraid to ask the questions and be a little vulnerable in those moments. And if you are rewarding those folks as the model of what you're wanting the team to do over time, that feels safe enough for everyone to do.
Yeah.
And so what I oftentimes find is that the folks that are quote unquote labeled resistors just don't feel safe enough to actually engage in that way and share. And oftentimes they have really good things to bring up, but it hasn't always been maybe safe for them or for others to share, you know, dissent amongst the ranks, if you will, without some form of your exact description, which is, well, if I even say that I'm not aligned with this, I'm going to be the one that they work around, and they're just going to set me aside until basically they're going to lay me off and say that I don't align with the, you know, needs of the team anymore.
Yeah.
And especially in today's world where layoffs have become very, very common and frequent.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me, one of my mentors, Ian McDonald, talks about when you go and do listening in an organization, sometimes the real gems will come from somewhere you don't expect, and that you can't just pay attention to the heat map of, hey, this is what we're hearing, because that one person that's brave enough to say something you don't expect may in fact be the spokesperson for a lot of people that weren't brave enough, weren't ready to say the thing. And he's seen that in his career, particularly when you're looking at like white collar, blue collar workforce interfaces and seams, or distributed large global organizations. So that is fascinating, like the way that you frame it, celebrate, reward the people who stand up and do dissent or do ask the uncomfortable question. I think that's a good way to not only to create a sense of trust, but to just kind of build that behavior over time, make it part of the culture.
Well, and I think there's also something around like the strength and courage that it takes for that person to do that too. That is something that's to be celebrated, right? Even though maybe what they're saying isn't what you would love for them to say.
Yeah.
Like the fact that they stood up, that they were willing to share, that they were willing to bring light to something that maybe you'd never heard, seen, or felt before.
Yeah.
That should just be celebrated in general. That's you know, I think that's human.
Yeah.
And if we had more of that, we'd have a lot more candor in our organizations. And quite frankly, probably a lot of decisions that maybe would have never gotten very far had some folks stood up and said, I don't think that sounds like the best plan, and here's why. And I think that's something to be celebrated in organizations, especially ones that want to be innovative.
Yes. Yeah, because to be innovative, to your earlier point, you have to make this cultural. Like, you're not going to do one transformation every 3 years. You've got to be handling constant change.
Absolutely.
I love that. So let's go a little bit deeper into the neuroscience then, because you framed this really well, Travis, that people are going to have this protective response. It's just in our wiring. It's biology. And I'm hearing some really neat frameworks around the roles in change or loss and the types of loss. But if we really get into what's happening biologically, is that something that a leader, or how do you in the book or in your work help a leader to understand at that sort of more micro level?
Yeah, so I talk a lot about kind of my research and where I've identified six barriers that exist within our neurology to change, and that cause natural resistance. Mm-hmm. And so that's usually where I start. And I talk about those six, and I'm happy to kind of talk through them at a really high level, Dane. The way I look at them, and again, this is the, let's call it the not even 101 version, but the book is like the 301 version. So if you want to get into the real meat of it, it's not here, but I'll give you a taste. You know, the first is habits and routine. Our brains love familiar patterns, and it's because they save energy. It makes it simple to do the things that we do. It's proven, it's safe, it's the way that we know it works. So our brains love habits and routines. Yeah. Change makes us step away from them.
Yeah.
And our brain doesn't love that. The second is just simply the learning curve and the amount of energy and cognitive effort that it takes to change. That's exhausting. That engages our prefrontal cortex. It's why you're always exhausted after a day at a conference, even though you sat and listened. It's exhausting to take in new information and make sense of it and connect with it. And all change requires that if you're going to step away from routines.
Yep.
The third barrier has to do with exclusion. So change is usually designed by a small group and then handed to everyone else. So that experience is exclusionary by its nature.
Mm.
And our brains see that as a form of threat. And the reason is if you look back in early days of humans, our brain was meant to look at our world as, are we surviving or not surviving? And one of the key differentiators of, if you are part of a group, survival is exponentially more likely.
Yeah.
And so our brain has a bias for inclusion and being parts of groups because of that. So change, again, creates that exclusion, which naturally our brains push against.
Yeah.
The fourth barrier is around ambiguity, and all change introduces ambiguity to organizations. So when people don't have clarity, their brain starts to fill in blanks. And usually it doesn't write a very kind or generous story.
Yeah.
Oftentimes our brain's looking at it from a sense of what's the worst case scenario that I might have to be prepared for.
Yes.
And then that takes off, right? There's also some chemical things that happen in our brains that drive us to validate assumptions. And then we start talking to other people and then we start making joint narratives and then that becomes very strong. Anyway, long road. But the rumor mill is a real thing and there's a reason for it, right?
Yeah.
The fifth is around anxiety and threat. So our amygdala is constantly scanning for what could go wrong and trying to assess, are we safe? That's the fight or flight. A lot of us sit in a level of anxiety within our lives that is quite heightened, especially with everything that's going on. At work, we only really know a portion of what someone's anxiety levels are.
Yes.
And it's because that's the only part that we control.
Yeah.
So, in our world, I think that that's just such a thing that we can't always know, but it happens. And being aware of that is really important as we're going through change.
Yeah.
And then the final one is loss. And we kind of talked about that already, but every change is loss and it involves giving something up. And so the power of those six barriers is that it really gives leaders a way to diagnose what's happening instead of treating resistance all the same. Each of those barriers is very different. There's very different questions that leaders can ask. There's very different reflections on how leaders are leading that deal with each of those barriers and whether or not they're activating or deactivating those barriers.
Yeah.
And so it's been a really good way for leaders to give a more tactical checklist style look at, okay, here are the barriers. What are we doing for each of these? Or what are we doing that we shouldn't be doing that's activating each of these barriers?
Oh, I love that. The common theme there then through all six is energy. There's an energy management element in all of them, whether it's the habits and routine that you talked about, the learning curve, ambiguity, loss, it's always going to have an impact on my energy. And that's probably one of the biggest things I've been exploring in neuroscience right now, whether it's sleep, whether it's breathing, whether it's diet, whether it's dancing, singing, is that as humans, we have only so much energy. And you touched on it in this highly anxious time that I think people are living through in the world at large, where work's only a part of their anxiety equation. One of my coaches says the pipe that we would normally be bringing to work is already kind of being encroached upon. So I guess for leaders out there who are sitting there going, well, I've managed changes like this before, but why is this one feeling slower and harder? Those barriers are probably pointing towards it in a more holistic sense.
Yeah, they are. And I like to talk about it as you've got one can of gas and you have to try to go as far as you can with that can of gas. What goes further? The trusty Toyota that gets, 50 miles to the gallon?
Yeah.
Or the Ferrari?
Yeah.
Right? You're going to take the Toyota if your goal is to get as far as you can, right? And that's what our brain does every day. It tries to get as far as it can with the energy that we have.
Yeah.
The one thing that I... I would play off of what you said there too. All of them have, I would say, kind of two themes. One is energy, and the other is threat. And I think it's like those two threads run very parallel. And it's because in order to respond to threat, you need to have the energy
that's the formula.
And so I think that they play together in that way. And it's your brain saying, if we're unsafe and we do need to go, you know, it doesn't know the difference between a work stress and the saber-toothed tiger.
Yeah.
Like, our brain reacts the same way it did back when that was a real threat predator, right?
Yeah.
So its response is, I need to have energy to fight or flee if that's the case, right? And so that needs to have that confidence that, like, there's energy here to expend should we need it. And that's why those mechanisms are in place,
yeah.
Honestly.
That's interesting, the Ford versus Ferrari, the threat versus energy, because it also would suggest if you're wanting to put a whole tank of gas to work and go really fast, which I think a lot of companies are doing right now with AI, and your team members are sitting there trying to keep some reserves at hand, they don't want to go through the Ferrari moment. And that is tough. And particularly if there's three of those changes happening all at once. That's really interesting. So how do you map, how as a leader do you map some of those barriers that are showing up on your team without having to go and, you know, survey each team member on all six things and be like, where are you at in this change?
It's a great question. I refer to it as being a resistance fortune teller. I was given that nickname once at an organization by a CHRO because we were having a long conversation about they were bringing a change to one of their teams. And I was like, okay, I was using my neuroscience hat. And I was like, here are the things they're going to go through.
Yeah.
Here's what we need to be prepared for. You know, here's the Q&A that I anticipate is going to happen. Here's the number one question. The first question you're going to get asked is this. And then we got done with this town hall and the CHRO was like, God, you're like a resistance fortune teller. You called it. That was absolutely the question that they had. We're so glad that we had an answer for that question. And the reality of that is, and the reality of the neurology and the neuroscience is that all of these things have tells. And I talk about it a lot in the book of like things that happen when people get into these certain states. Exclusion is a great example of this, where people actually physically respond to exclusion. So it's not just, oh, I'm feeling excluded in my brain. You can watch people in rooms when they're not included.
They shrink.
Start to shrink, start to move away, start to cross arms, start to protect. Like, you can see it all happen. And so when you start as a leader, if you're being observant and you start to see that happening, you're like, ooh, okay, there's exclusion happening here. We need to try to bring this back to a place of inclusion.
Yeah.
The other thing is that this happens often when we're doing technology changes, where you'll go and do these trainings, people will be like rocking it for like 3 days.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like, it just drops and no one's using the new system. Everyone's coming back and being like, I don't remember what we do next. I don't know how this is supposed to work. That right there is an issue with both routine and time and learning. Those two things are battling in that moment where maybe they've only built routine up to step three, and now they don't remember what step four is because they didn't have the capacity to learn step four in that moment.
Brilliant.
And so you start to see those things happen. And as a leader, when you notice them, you can be like, ooh, this is either a routine issue or a learning issue. Let me go ask some questions. Like, let me listen better. Let me ask, you know, myself some questions. Did I try to cram all of this training into one day and it was 8 straight hours? And what I'm seeing is that the first 3 hours went really well and the last 5 went really poorly.
I've been guilty of that many times.
We all have. We all have, because time and money and all of those things dictate some of the ways that we move, right? But that's the beauty of the neuroscience, the neurology, is that all of these things have tells.
Yeah.
As a leader, as you learn them, you can start to predict where people are sitting. And then oftentimes there's multiple barriers at play, but it gives you the questions and the open-ended things to be asking your team during one-on-ones or team meetings.
Yeah.
And you can ask them in very innocent ways. Like, you know, how did you guys feel the training went? I felt like the first half of the day was really strong and the second half maybe not as strong. Thoughts?
Yeah.
And then people are like, yeah, you're right. Like the first half went really well, but I'll be honest, I was exhausted by the second half and I wasn't really taking it in. You're like, okay.
Yeah.
We got to redo the second half of that day.
Oh, right? Yeah. That's brilliant. So if you're in a big company and you're rolling waves of these trainings out, you can kind of learn as you go. But if you're a small team and you're like, hey, there's 50 of us, we want to launch this new system by September 1st. We've got 90 days. How do you get a hold of some of those tells before you're into the change? Are there ways to kind of go around and look at past change efforts, you know, do a bit of investigative kind of storytelling? How do you see that?
Well, if you have enough history with a team, you can probably guess pretty quickly where their barriers are going to lie in the change, which is the beauty of that kind of longevity and team building. Mm. But the other side of it too, especially when you have small teams, is a lot of times trying to do everyone learning together is not going to be your best bang for your buck.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I've seen be really successful is where you'll do some upfront, like small learnings, shall we say, like it's an hour of learning as a team. And then you carve out time for specific individuals throughout the week to actually play with it. And you give people time to go in and learn kind of on their own. And then you bring everyone back at another time to ask questions, to push on it.
Yeah.
What did you see? What did you learn? But having that dedicated time is really important. And I think we're seeing that a lot in AI right now, where we're throwing the tools at people and we're giving all these big trainings, but we're not necessarily protecting time for people to go in and start to play and actually learn. And they're kind of doing it as their day job is still going on. So they're not really getting deep into it. They're not having that kind of time. And a lot of times what's been very successful is saying, okay, we've got five people on our team. Let's start with five. I'm going to say each of you gets an afternoon where we'll pick up a little bit of the slack. I'll watch the chat for you. Just go check into this tool. I want you to look at maybe two or three things that you think could be really impactful for you using AI.
Mm.
And then come back and we're all going to talk about it next week. Like, what did you see? What did you find? What did you play with? Like, what did it look like? And so protecting that time for people to go and actually do is so critical. And then you brought up a really interesting thing about energy earlier that I couldn't not say. We oftentimes forget that it's not just the active part of learning that's important. It's also the inactive part.
Mm.
So learning truly takes root during the inactive part. And sleep is essential to learning.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize that. And a lot of people don't acknowledge that sleep is important. And so when you've got these, you know, grueling 8-hour days of training, that there's no way someone's going to get enough sleep and recharge in order for all of that to sink in.
Okay.
Right. So having to think through some of that is really important too.
Oh, I love that. So now I'm going to plan my trainings with a nap window to follow them.
You know, I say the Spanish have it right with a little siesta in the
they
afternoon.
They totally
it's
do.
Not, it's not a terrible
then do a bit more work than a late dinner party. They kind of get it all right. There's a lot of neuroscience in Spanish living. Love that.
That they've just been naturally doing for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, a good friend of mine, Jacob Taylor, I think he started his life as a rugby player, but then moved into anthropology. And he and I had a great conversation and he was like, you know, as thinking human beings, we've lost track with a lot of our like wiring, grounding, attachment to earth. Like there was a lot of things that past cultures did that was really important and we're not making time for it anymore, whether that's at work or away from work. Which is a big part of my curiosity around what can neuroscience tell us around these moments and how can it help, you know, better fuel the teams to be going through the change?
Well, what's really interesting is that, you know, if you think back to the 90s, and not to date myself, but if you think back to the 90s, everyone was really concerned that lack of access to the internet and computers was going to be a differentiator and a giant gap between the wealthy and those who are not.
Yeah.
And it was a big concern. And that's why there's all these grants to put computers in schools and make sure that internet was accessible and all this stuff. And you see how actually now folks with money and wealthy people are actually removing that from access to their kids.
Yep.
And the reason is because we found out that actually the access to information was not the differentiator. It was the ability to critical think.
Yes.
And when you have that much access to information, you don't need to critically think.
No.
And that's something that we learn as kids, as we learn as young adults.
Yep.
And we try to navigate our world. We're trying to find information. That ability to find and critically think about information is such an important skill.
Yeah.
That a lot of kids today have not had to learn because they have access to all the information at their fingertips.
I agree. I think there's a lot to be said for the skills decay that many current day professionals have lived through over the last 20 to 30 years because of information in the classroom and just the way that we're living. That takes me back to the point that you touched on pre-show, Travis, which was the upside of AI is that a lot of the programming, scheduling, task definition is now being heavily augmented. So leaders and transformation teams have more time to really be diving into what you framed as like caring for the experience of the employees at large. What are some signs, some evidence of where you're seeing that show up in teams and change efforts, and what might that look like for a team different from, you know, what they've been accustomed to in past change efforts?
I think it's doing two things, and it's doing two things really well, actually. The first is it's allowing for, like, my team in particular, we're able to take some of the time that we were spending on a lot of that run the day-to-day, and we're able to put that back into spending more time with people and the people that are going through these changes and these transformations. So, you know, I don't have to spend 3 hours creating a slide deck. I can get AI to create me at least the start of a slide deck, and I'll tweak it. But now I can spend those 3 hours hosting a focus session or talking to people in a group that I know are having trouble with this change or this transformation. So that's kind of one side. The other side is scalability. So, you know, before, if I think about the way that we were bringing change to people and kind of what the best practices were saying, it was things like, oh, we need frequently asked questions documents, and we need to build these, you know, these moments in for office hours and these large group meetings and all this stuff. Well, AI allows us to bring a lot of that in the flow of people's work.
Yeah.
So I can spend time arming AI with the data that it needs to answer the questions that people are going to have. And AI can actually scale that question and answer moment to the entire organization in a moment, right? And then you, Dane, don't have to sit there and say, oh, shoot, an hour after that session, I had the question, and now our next one isn't until next week, and now I got to go try to track this down on my own anyway.
Love that.
You can literally go, and we use Slackbot. You can literally go to Slackbot and say, Slackbot, I have a question about this. What does this mean? And it can pull that information from a place that we've designed with actual factual vetted information. So it's really in the flow of people's work. And we can spend our time on the more meaningful and impactful things, which are getting more time with our people.
Oh, I love that. I think that's really powerful. And I would imagine just from some of my own AI projects lately, I've been actually Jonathan, who I mentioned earlier, Jonathan Raymond, I've been helping him build Wren, which sits in the Slack channel. What we're finding is that Wren can now surface questions that haven't actually yet been asked, but it's starting to pick up the signal amongst the team. So, you know, let's say you'd built up your library, and then all of a sudden you're like, hey, people are all talking about this thing, but no one's asking it. And then you can kind of, you can get the AI to start manifesting, hey, here's the question that is on people's minds that they're not asking, and here's a way for us to bring that conversation to the floor, whether it's in person or whether it's putting out a some kind of, you know, digital learning space.
And that's such a, it's, it is such a double-edged sword, though, in like the access, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, because we haven't typically used our like chat tools in a way that we would want AI combing, right?
Yes.
Oftentimes the conversations we're having, we think are very private in that space. And so, you know, AI combing some of that, you're like, you're getting these messages from AI. Like, I think everyone's really upset with Dane.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily what I think the end user wants AI to be able to surface necessarily. But I think it's really amazing how it can pick up on the signals of like, hey, everyone's kind of like trying to find this thing, but no one's like actually asking where it's at.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
or going back to your earlier point, this is one that Ren helped me with the other day when you said, we've got to recognize and reward the people who speak up. You know, I can go into the Slack channel and say, hey, looking back over the last week, you know, what couple of things have I not, perhaps not spotted on my team? It'll be like, oh, Anthony over here raised a concern on this project and you didn't praise him for it publicly. If you've built your context layer to say we praise these behaviors, it can help you as a leader hold yourself accountable. And I'm, for one of those leaders that sucks at praise. So I've got to get a lot better at that. And anytime I've got someone in my corner teeing me up to go out and do it, that's better.
Oh, it's so much better. And like, even for me, you know, I've built skills where I can actually go in and be like, I'm just chatting with my skill, where I'm like, hey, was just in a meeting with this person. They did such a good job articulating X. And like, it'll actually log it for me.
Brilliant.
In a document.
Yeah.
So that I can go back to it. But I can do it in real time. So I'm not like, okay, let me find the document. I just like click my little thing and I'm do 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 do. And then it's logged for me later. To your point, I can also query it to say, hey, what are some things, I'm going to meet with Dane later today, what are some things in the last couple of weeks that I've noticed in, you know, his performance that I want to be sure I bring up?
Oh, I love that. I love that. All right. Well, it's a great point to end on that now there's more time for caring for the experience of people. And they feel it, going back to everything that we've talked about today, whether it's the types of loss, competence, relationships, control, the roles that people are having to play in that change process. I love the lead, drive, and be recipient of. And I particularly like those six barriers. So I love that you walked us through, you know, how it shows up and that interesting relationship between threat and energy for people. If anyone's out there who's listening here, which I'm sure there'll be many who are like, it feels like my team's really stuck right now. We're not getting through these changes. We're not embracing this new tool we've launched. How do they best come and find you, Travis, or the book Rethink Resistance?
Yeah, absolutely. Rethink Resistance is available anywhere books are sold. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. You can learn more about me, my work at just my website, travishaler.com. And you can connect with me on LinkedIn. I always say this, I read all my own messages. So if you want to like give me feedback, you want to ask questions, I always read my own messages and respond. So I'd love to hear what you're thinking and how this resonates.
Love it. And I really appreciate, Travis, the way you've taken the neuroscience space, which I'm fascinated by, and actually grounded it practically in the field guide and the tools that people can use. So I'm excited to dive into the book.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. It's been a pleasure.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.